This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The only way you're going to get a switch in the economy from the current reliance on fossil fuels is with a price on carbon that's significant enough to start switching the economy.
We hear a lot about putting a price on carbon, but what does it really mean? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Mark Shapiro, an investigative journalist and the author of Carbon Shock, helps us understand the bustling carbon market that already exists and explains the carbon taxes that all of us are already paying, whether we know it or not. Listen now as Shapiro explores the fundamental question of who should bear the burden of an overheated planet that's resulted from the burning of cheap fossil fuels over the past century and a half.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mark Shapiro. He's an investigative journalist and journalism professor at UC Berkeley School of Journalism. And he's also the author of the new book, Carbon Shock. Mark, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, thanks.
So give us a brief summary of Carbon Shock, if you will.
I think the climate, interesting number, on a number of different levels. Number one, it is the fundamental issue that we are facing in our lifetime. This is the fundamental environmental question. But I wanted to look at that in a different way, in a way that I don't think had been covered very substantially by the press. We've reached a point where we've gone through the science. The science is very clearly established. We went through battles over the last decade or two over the fake battles, actually. But by now, I don't even think it's worth even calling any debate about the science of climate change. It is happening. So the question I wanted to look at is, what are the economic implications of this phenomenon that we call climate change? Essentially, the atmosphere is going through this enormous turbulence because of the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And what I wanted to look at was the economic implications down here on Earth of this enormous shifts going on in the conditions under which we are living. And so my book was really an effort to go around the world, which I did do, to different parts of the world where the costs of climate change are being experienced today, right now. And the struggle is underway to sort of contend with those costs and to try to integrate them into the economy. The book, if you want to look at it in economist language, is a narrative of externalized costs. What are externalized costs? And I'll tell you just very quickly what an externalized cost is when it comes to climate change is the ultimate story about externalized costs. Environmental journalism really focuses around this notion of externalized costs, of the way that society bears the financial burden of problems caused by, in this case, fossil fuel producers. So I was just down, for example, 2 weeks ago, I was down in New Orleans for a Society of Environmental Journalists conference. And I took a walk along the new levees that are being built by the Army Corps of Engineers to protect New Orleans from a flood akin to what happened after Hurricane Katrina. And what was amazing is, number one, they're probably building these monster concrete barriers that are going to prevent a repetition of what happened after Katrina. But two, these have cost about $14 billion to build surrounding New Orleans. God knows New Orleans is worth saving and doing whatever we can to save it as a city. But the question is, who pays for that? So in a way, we paid for it, American taxpayers. We've all contributed to those levies, rightfully so. But this is a cost that one could call an externalized cost of climate change, because all scientists say that essentially the intensity with which Katrina hit New Orleans was related directly to the conditions brought by climate change. So when you take that as an example and you extrapolate it by thousands and thousands of instances, from the droughts to the extreme storms to the effects on public health of the expansion of certain tropical-borne diseases as it gets warmer, you begin to see what the nature is of an externalized cost. It's the cost created by our use of fossil fuels that is not paid for by those who profit from fossil fuels. And my book was an effort to go around to different parts of the world to document the stories, the experiences that people are having in real time of that kind of disruption.
So I want to dive into the North-South issue later with trying to figure out how to value carbon and how the developing world can be a productive part of climate negotiations and carbon markets in the future. But let's first focus on three cities that you decided to examine in your book, which are all in the Northern Hemisphere: Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Manchester, England, and Guangzhou in China. All manufacturing hubs at one time or another, all going in very different directions. Well, why'd you choose those cities, and maybe extrapolate on how they reflect the evolving world of how we price carbon, or how we will price carbon in the future?
I started with the two cities. I started with Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Manchester in England. These two have very common histories in their countries. Of course, Pittsburgh, center of steel industry, center of massive industrial innovation in the 19th century all the way through to the 20th century until about the 1980s when the steel industry began leaving Pittsburgh. Manchester, United Kingdom, the seat of the Industrial Revolution for all of us, is where a lot of the kind of first factories, modern factories, were built based on fossil fuels, based on using coal and oil as an energy source. Enormous amount of innovation came out of Manchester, the industrial seat of England, really, and huge textile industries as well as other heavy industries in Manchester. In Pittsburgh, you had in the beginning of the 1980s into the 1990s, the flight of the steel industry, right? It was the center of the American steel industry in the 70s. By the early 90s, there's barely even a handful of steel processing facilities in Pittsburgh. They've essentially become a deindustrialized city. And after the enormous trauma to the working people in those factories, which has taken about 25 years or so, the city is beginning to reconstitute itself in a much greener direction. So Pittsburgh has become, actually, its greenhouse gases plunged after the steel industry left. And it's now one of the top, you could say about the top 20 cities in terms of being a clean city. So my question was, what happened to the greenhouse gases that were once in Pittsburgh? Well, guess what? They didn't just go disappear. They too went to China, along with all those factories that used to be in Pittsburgh, took with them their greenhouse gases. And so I wanted to use Pittsburgh as an example of this quandary we face, because what happens in China? In Guangzhou, which is basically one of the most industrialized hubs in China, many of those steel factories used to be in Pittsburgh, are now in Guangzhou. And in addition to the steel that they're now making that used to be made in Pittsburgh, they're also producing greenhouse gases. Where is that steel exported to? Well, it's exported to Pittsburgh and the United States more broadly. All those car doors, all those refrigerator doors, all those car chassis, all the kind of structure, the girders for skyscrapers, steel. Where's it coming from? China. And where's it often coming from is Guangzhou in China, which has been the place where the steel industry moved to from Pittsburgh. Now, Guangzhou is, of course, one of the top greenhouse gas emitting provinces in China, maybe in the world, because it's such an industrialized center. So one of the very interesting questions about greenhouse gases and how to deal with them as we move forward is, how do we account for the greenhouse gases in China's exports to America? So literally the World Bank and other institutions have estimated that about 25% of the China's total greenhouse gas emissions come from the manufacture of goods for export to the United States and the European Union. What does that mean? Who's responsible for those emissions? Is it the manufacturer who creates the emissions in China, or is it the consumer, meaning us, who are consuming the goods that have what are known in this field as embedded emissions? They're emissions embedded in the product. And so I wanted to look at that phenomenon, which is a pretty interesting, it gives you a kind of a different way to understand actually China's role as the world's leading greenhouse gas emitter as it is. And so I wanted to look at two cities that had very different approaches to that question of how do you deal with embedded emissions. And when you look at Manchester in the United Kingdom, very similar to Pittsburgh, a super industrialized city for, 150, 170, 180 years until the textile industry there began moving to India. And that started happening between the 1970s and 1990s, massive flight of big industry from Manchester to Asia. And similar situation. All that manufactured stuff being exported back to Manchester in the United Kingdom, including all those greenhouse gases. Well, Manchester has a very interesting way to deal with this question of how to take responsibility for all those emissions in those exported products. And it is to actively put pressure, for example, on the municipal procurement system and on local companies to actually reduce the greenhouse gases at every step of the supply chain, to encourage more energy efficient technologies in the companies that supply both the city government and the local population with goods through various complicated trade negotiations, to encourage greater efficiency up and down the supply chain. And they actually include those embedded emissions in their accounting every year to the United Kingdom government. Each city has to give an accounting of its greenhouse gases. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, while taking very active steps to become a greener city, specifically excludes the embedded emissions from their mandate. So they basically have, and I've read both of the climate plans for both, believe it or not, I've actually read this stuff, the climate plan for Manchester and the climate plan for Pittsburgh. And it's very interesting to see the different approaches of these two very similar cities, both, by the way, trying to take initiatives to make themselves more, quote, green, but both actually taking very different approaches to this notion of responsibility for the emissions embedded in the goods that we import from China. And because Pittsburgh explicitly excludes the accounting for those emissions. And I raise that not to necessarily say that Pittsburgh is doing something bad in this world. It's not to, Pittsburgh has made a valiant effort to kind of green itself in some profound way. But there's a fundamental question that these two cities raises about how we deal with greenhouse gases going forward. Do we place the onus of responsibility on the manufacturer of goods, or do we place the burden of responsibility on we the consumers, or do we find a way to balance out that burden, which is, I think, the way we need to go for the most sort of equitable solution to this situation?
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mark Shapiro. He's an investigative journalist and the author of Carbon Shock. What are some of the examples of ways that we are pricing carbon in a marketplace internationally? And what are some of the solutions that seem to be the most equitable and leave most parties satisfied with the policies that have been put in place?
Yeah. So first, let's talk about what the carbon markets are intended to do. What is their purpose? And which brings us back very quickly to 1997, Kyoto, Japan, where the world's leaders gathered really for the first global summit to basically begin devising a common global strategy to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And their primary challenge at that time was to devise a price for carbon that would actually reflect its actual costs, to the atmosphere. And so at that time, there were a lot of negotiations. The Europeans wanted a carbon tax. The Americans, led by Al Gore and Bill Clinton, wanted a carbon market and basically said that we cannot do a carbon tax. We are going to, we insist on this kind of market approach. And now we can talk about what that market approach has been, which, by the way, 4 years later, of course, George Bush was elected president and withdrew from the Kyoto process altogether, which left the European Union and Japan and the other signatories to Kyoto to execute what was essentially an American idea. What is that idea? That's this notion of cap and trade, these carbon markets where companies, industrial companies, are issued emission limits to try to bring the emission limits down from levels in 1990 over time. And essentially, if you are emitting over your limit, you have to go buy allowances to enable you to keep polluting. And if you are emitting under, you can sell your allowances, which is supposed to be an economic incentive to reduce your emissions. And this market in pollution allowances is now a huge market in the European Union, which is, by the way, is 28 countries, and it's the biggest economy in the world. The European Union, as well as Japan, New Zealand, and a couple of other countries, very small countries. It's basically centered in Europe. And that's because the United States pulled out of Kyoto. And the performance of these markets, number one, we have to understand these are major financial forces. We are talking about several hundreds of billions of dollars have passed through these markets over the past 6 or 7 years, hundreds of billions of dollars. So this is a very important sort of engine of money moving through these markets.
So we're all familiar with a marketplace, like going to Walmart and understanding that you get your jeans will be coming from overseas possibly, and there's a marketplace there. But when we talk about a carbon marketplace, what does that really mean?
That's a good question. And I would love to tell you it's a bunch of guys jumping up and down with a big picture of carbon in front of them, some old coal, you know, briquette or something. Actually, it's a highly computer. I went to the carbon trading floor, one of them anyway, in London, the main one in London. It's a bunch of mostly guys, some gals, but it's basically, you know, mostly guys sitting in front of computers moving digits on the screen. And actually, it's interesting. I talked to a lot of traders who actually trade in the price of carbon because the price oscillates on a daily basis, just like pork bellies or just like silver. It goes up and down. And a lot of the guys trading in carbon now used to be trading in oil and gas. And now they just figure, well, here's another commodity. It comes in the energy field. And so they switch from oil and gas, which, of course, are the creators of greenhouse gases to begin with. So they went from speculating on the price of fossil fuels, essentially, to now speculating on the price of the waste of fossil fuels, which is greenhouse gas emission. The idea is to invest in this commodity that is intended to disappear. The whole point of investing in a ton of carbon, and it is traded in tons of carbon, is to make it disappear, to not be there over time. And this has created this kind of very counterintuitive, complicated idea to get a hold of, has made this a very difficult market to regulate.
Well, does this include when you're saying it's meant to disappear, you mean burning the fossil fuel?
No, you are investing in a pollution permit that is ultimately designed to eliminate the need for itself over time. Because if the market worked as it's supposed to work, which is another question, but if it was to work as it's supposed to work, the price of those permits would keep going up and up and up and up, and therefore people would move gradually away from fossil fuels so they don't have to buy any more of those permits and begin putting that money, instead of buying permits, they would put their money into solar power or wind power. So the intention of this market is to make the need for itself essentially disappear. And of course, one of the central problems of these markets is that, number one, the price has never actually gotten high enough to encourage a significant shift to renewable energy. So it's really, right now, it's hovering at about $10 a ton.
So carbon is priced at $10 a ton on the market.
On the European market. And roughly that same thing on the California market, by the way.
And there's some that think it should be like $150 a ton, right?
Right, right. So there are people now saying it should be $150 a ton. Very serious resource economists are saying if we really want to switch gears and change the economic order here, we have to really start upping the price of carbon. And that's why this question of what is the price of carbon is a very key question. Anybody you talk to, from a municipal planner to a resource economist to an environmental official to, by the way, oil company executive, of whom I've spoke with several, to other resource industries, say that the only way you're going to get a switch in the economy from the current reliance on fossil fuels is with a price on carbon that's significant enough to start switching the economy in another direction, a more renewable direction.
I was born by the river, oh, in a little old tent. Oh, I just like the river. I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change has gotta come. Oh, yes, it will. Been too hard living, oh, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know change is gonna come.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mark Shapiro. He's an investigative journalist and the author of Carbon Shock. So, Mark, when we're talking about putting a price on carbon, we've been speaking so far about a bilateral kind of engagement. But could we triangulate this to include clean energy solutions for countries that have, this is their time to be able to enjoy the benefits of the modern industrial world and being able to burn the carbon that countries like the U.S. and Great Britain have done for 100 years. So now let's take, I don't know, Angola or the Ivory Coast. So the leaders of those countries want to be able to provide their people with those similar comforts that we here in the U.S. have benefited from a long time. So is there a way to take those monies that are being traded in carbon and funnel them into clean energy solutions?
First of all, yes, you've raised a very key tension point in the negotiations, which is, of course, that the rapidly developing countries like Brazil, China, India, South Africa, are arguing that, wait a minute, you Western developed countries got all this cheap energy for all these like two centuries, and now you're expecting us to pay the full cost of all the externalized costs while we're suffering the consequences of all that fossil fuel waste going into the atmosphere, and now you want us to pay more for energy? This central divide it's been one of the key reasons why it's been very difficult to come up with a global approach, because actually the most rapid growth in the use of fossil fuels is actually in the developing world. Any global accord really has to take serious account of the fact that there needs to be investment by the developed countries in the renewable energy technologies and renewable energy development in the developing countries, that discrepancy in the pricing of energy is a real concern, and that has certainly caught the attention of the world. I think this dynamic is changing as we move towards their climate negotiations in Lima, Peru in November. And then that's really laying the groundwork for the mega climate negotiations, which are going to be in Paris in 2015, when the world is expected to negotiate a new global climate accord. And that's where everybody's looking forward now.
Is there a mechanism in place or being discussed to try to bring a third party, kind of thinking of like the mercantilist societies, basically, and getting the clean energy solution to kind of offset that in needier places for energy?
I mean, that is the idea of a offset. So basically, some people are probably familiar with the term offset, which kind of came up with the invention of the carbon markets, and this notion that basically industrial companies could purchase permits to pollute, but even less expensive, they could buy an offset, which means they could actually invest, for example, in a wind farm in Mexico, or a way to channel methane gas from a pig farm in China. The idea was to channel money from the developed country industries to the developing countries, to these things called offsets.
These are the clean development mechanisms, or CDMs, that you describe in the book, right?
Yes.
So what does that mean?
Good question. That means that essentially, under the theory that a greenhouse gases reduced in one place have the same impact on the atmosphere as reducing them somewhere else, and that the requirement that industries reduce their greenhouse gas emissions in the developed world could be met at least partially by investing in greenhouse gas emission reductions in developing countries. So in those countries, some of which you mentioned, some of them, you know, right now there's a lot of offset projects in Indonesia, in Kenya, in Tanzania. Not so much in their super poor countries, because the infrastructure there is so poor, it's very hard to support. But in other countries, for example, the Congo, Latin American countries, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, there are these kind of offset projects. And the question is how reliable those are as offsets. Do they actually lead to emission reductions? So I think if we're going to continue with the carbon market approach, we need to find ways to increase substantially the integrity with which these market mechanisms function.
Carbon Shock is the book. The author is Mark Shapiro, who's an investigative journalist. Mark, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by M. Ward, Stephen Stills, and Herbie Hancock with James Morrison.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.